wasn't allowed to develop anywhere else. I was so disappointed. I felt like I found and lost my guy. A few years later, when I was putting the pieces together for Sebastian Says, I reached out to Austin again, and was thrilled that he was available. In all the years of meeting writers, I never clicked with anyone like I did with him. We had a lot in common. We come from the same type of background, blue-collar family. He married a woman from an upper-class family. We're both driven, have a sense of humor, and ride scooters. You don't find too many guys who drive Vespas. The only minor difference was he went to Brown, an Ivy League school, and studied American literature, while I went to Northern Illinois University, where I reprimanded my fraternity brothers for pissing in the Tri-Sigs mailbox. Austin and I used our similarities to pitch to the network. He's middle class, I'm middle class, I said in meetings. He married into a wealthy family, I married into one. He drives a Vespa, I drive a Vespa. We see the world the same way. We understand each other's lives. On the strength of that, we were able to convince NBC to give us a deal. And Greg Garcia, my name is Earl, the Millers, and yes, dear, came on board. Suddenly, I had a network deal, and I was in business with Greg, a well-respected showrunner. The pieces were lining up. It didn't take long for Austin and me to hash out the script. I'd give him characters, and he formulated the dialogue. He would call me up about this situation or that one and ask, "What would your father say? What would Lana say?" The show was all about the tension between my old-school, set-in-his-ways immigrant father and my young wife and her modern California sensibility, with me in the middle. Loosely my life. Script in hand, the network gave us the green light to make a pilot episode, so now we had to find actors to play the parts. The three big roles were me, my wife, and my father. The network gave us a list of every actor in all of Hollywood who could pass for an Italian aged between 65 and 68 years old. Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Joe Mantegna were on the list. It was hundreds of names long, anybody who fit the description. I didn't even need the list. I already knew who I wanted to play my father. Tony Danza. I grew up watching Tony, and I felt as if I were already related to him. People told me growing up that I looked like him, and it made me feel cool. He was a veteran of two long-running hit sitcoms, Taxi and Who's the Boss. He hadn't done one since then, so it would be awesome to bring him into ours. I could see the headlines right now. Tony Danza plays up-and-coming comedian's father on new NBC show Sebastian Says. Greg got the script to Tony, and he responded within 24 hours to say he loved it and he was in. He gravitated towards the relationship between the father and the son. "This is how I grew up," he said. "And I have a son. I get it." It was exactly what I'd hoped to hear. For me, this news was another one of these moments when I couldn't believe a guy I grew up watching and admiring was interested in working with me. Negotiations with Tony took a while. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't care. I was just happy to be in the game working with Austin and Greg and most likely Tony Danza. Finally, after a few weeks of a lot of back and forth, Tony officially signed on. It was really happening. We had locked in a TV legend. It felt like we couldn't miss. As soon as the ink was dry on his contract, I reached out to Tony by DMing him on Twitter, writing, "Hey man, I'm so excited that you're doing the show. What a dream come true. Can't wait to meet you and learn from the best. Here's my personal information." He called and left a message that I didn't get right away because Lana and I were in Maui where I had a corporate gig. When we got to our hotel room, I saw the voicemail, and I played it for my wife. He said, "Hey, man, it's Tony. I'm really looking forward to this. Give me a call." It was one of those messages that, in the old days, the answering machine would have cut it off because it was so long. He sounded just like Tony Banta or Tony Maselli, that iconic voice that made listening to a message from him surreal. Lana and I just stared at each other in shock, replaying it, and she said, "Fucking Tony Danza just called you." For the rest of the trip, we would say, "Fucking Tony Danza," out of the blue, look at one another, and laugh. I called him back and suggested we meet before the upcoming table read of the script. He invited me to Florida to see his Frank Sinatra-type show where he sings with a band and does jokes in between songs, but I explained that I was unable to come because of the Maui gig. We decided to meet in New York for dinner the following week. I walked into Patsy's, an iconic Italian joint on West 56th Street, with photos on the walls of famous people who had eaten there. Tony was already in the back corner booth, holding court. The first thing I noticed about Tony Danza, he's got a crooked pinky finger from boxing. Second thing, he is very nice, very personable. He knew every waiter by name, like, "Hey Frank, another martini for my friend." Third thing, he has lived an incredible life and has so many stories that we could have sat there until the morning. From Frank Sinatra stories to his kids, his career, his fantastic cheese shop in Little Italy called Oliva Dairy, I could have listened all night long. He's 65 but has the energy of a 30-year-old. I asked him question after question, like, how do sitcoms work? What could I expect? I didn't know anything, but he knew everything and was only too happy to tell me. He also shared that he'd been researching his part in Sebastian Says, and he had assembled a New York City cast of characters who resembled the ones on the show so he could practice. I never even heard someone doing that. And I was blown away that he was doing all this work and really diving in to make this show a hit. We closed the place down. It felt like I'd known him forever. Tony was down to earth and present. We ended the night taking a photo with a Frank Sinatra statue in the restaurant, like any two good Italian boys should. The next day, I met with pilot director Scott Ellis. I talked to him about what to expect, too. I was going into uncharted territory. Part of me was a little worried that I wasn't going to be able to make it work. The show was written by Austin and me, starring me, based on my life, with my name in the title. The pressure was on. It was up to me to make the pilot good enough to air. If I established somewhat of a relationship with Tony Danza and the director before we got started on the production, it would be easier to hit the ground running and feel more confident on the set. I went back to LA and worked with Greg on every aspect of the show. The wardrobe, the setting, the casting. Lana was deep into curating all the visuals. When they designed the set, they made a miniature 3D model of it. They asked about every decision. From what fabric should go on the couch to the paintings on the walls. My wife is a perfectionist and always pushes for improvement. If they'd asked me which color for the curtains, I'd just pick one. But Lana would say, "Do you have another shade of purple?" In the beginning of our relationship, I used to get frustrated with her because she was so meticulous. But now I've learned to trust her with all things creative. And when I see her vision come to life, I'm always like, "Okay, now I get it." One of the biggest challenges we had was casting the character of my wife. It took me 35 years to find Lana, and I was trying to find someone to play her in 2 weeks. After seeing a lot of actresses, none of them right, Lana said, "I could do it," and started reading the lines with me. She was trying to help and had always secretly wanted to act, but this was not the time to do it. I needed an experienced pro for my pilot. I sat through every audition, which gave me an entirely different perspective on the audition process. Now that I was on the other side of the table, I understood that you know in an instant if someone is right for the part. As soon as actors filed in, you could see the nerves, the discomfort. People would make forced and awkward small talk. They might have been great actors, but for the most part, they were unable to act relaxed. From where I sat, I was rooting for every person who came in. The thing actors don't realize is that the people watching hope you will do well and make their jobs easier. We wanted them to knock it out of the park. When they didn't, it was always a disappointment. Casting is a laborious, long process. There were different opinions in the room, too. I only cared about whether someone was funny enough. I talked to Jerry after this process. In casting Seinfeld, he said, "People had to make me laugh." When you're doing a sitcom, the actors have to have that quality. If they're not making you laugh, They do not belong on the show. The network and other voices involved had other things to consider. In the end, we did put together a great cast, but I believe the overall vision of the show had been touched by too many hands. After seeing scores of actresses, Vanessa Lachey was the standout for the part of my wife and really nailed her audition. Lana saw her tape and agreed she was a fantastic choice. We then cast the supporting parts, the sister-in-law, her husband, their kid, my character's friends, and the tiny world of Sebastian Says was populated. So we had a script, a cast, a set, wardrobe, a director, a showrunner. It was a week out from the taping and we were finally good to go. Or so I thought. Network had a problem with the script. We did a table read, all the actors reading their lines, but not standing up and acting them, in front of a few executives. After we finished, the network head said there was a few things he didn't like the entire plot of the script. The pilot told the story of how my father wanted to murder a possum in the backyard, material straight from my act, by putting antifreeze on bologna, and my wife wanted to do it in a more humane way. The underlings had requested that we use this story for the pilot and told us they thought it was the perfect idea. But the network head didn't like it. Did the underlings then defend the script and tell their boss what they'd been telling us? No. It wouldn't have mattered if they had. Whatever the head guy liked, they had to agree with it. Whatever he didn't like, they fell in line with that too. Austin and I had to go back to the drawing board. We went in with something totally made up about Tony's character passing his apron, the one he always wore to cook Sunday supper, down to me so I could pick up the tradition. Part of the reason for the Sunday supper idea was to get everybody in the cast on the stage. It wasn't enough just to have the three main characters talking in the yard. The passing the baton concept wasn't from my real life, and it felt contrived. But we worked with the parameters we were given, and in the end, I loved the script. The relationships between the characters were well established. I couldn't have been more confident in Austin. He is a wordsmith, and his comedic chops are outstanding. One of the jokes was about having a problem with my wife's half-sister coming to Sunday supper. She said, "She's my sister." I said, "She's your half-sister. We don't have to invite her to everything." A little play on words there. Austin gave me great material to work with, and I believe the pilot was good enough for the network to order 6 or 7 more episodes. We'd have a chance to breathe a bit and take it further. Finally, after 6 months plus of hard work to get to this point, we were ready to shoot the pilot of Sebastian Says at CBS Radford Studios, on the same stage where Seinfeld had been filmed for 9 years. The vibes couldn't have been better. It was a big night, a big deal. My in-laws were in town, my mother, my father, and sister were coming. Everyone was going to be there for the taping. The shoot would be the first time we performed it in front of a live audience. As a comedian, I was excited to hear the real laughter. During the dress rehearsals, the studio had been empty except for the cast and crew. If you tell a joke in a studio where no one could hear it, is it still funny? At the taping, we'd find out. Basically, I was shitting, totally nervous. I've never done anything like this before. We started the opening scene with Vanessa and me in Whole Foods and how the store bothered me. There was a guy giving a massage, another touting the many uses of argan oil. A shopper number 5, wore hemp clothing, and I commented that it only comes in 2 colors, oatmeal and throw up. Then when we checked out at the cashier, it came out that I'd forgotten the reusable bags at home. I told the guy to just throw our stuff in the paper bag, and he judged me for not bringing my bag made out of wheat. In the next scene, I walked in the door to our home with all the groceries piled in my sweater, and I dumped them on the table. It was a funny bit and we were getting laughs, but the director would yell cut and suggest we reshoot the scene. The idea was to get the best take possible, but But when we repeated the scene or a single line over and over, the audience knew the joke was coming. In my act, I'd never stop after a bit and say, "Hold on, guys, hold on. I didn't do that quite right. I'm going to do it again." The jerky pace of the shoot took some getting used to. Sometimes Austin and Greg would come out of the bullpen, where they were watching the camera playback, and give me line changes and gesture modifications one after another, like, change this and say that and move here and not there. I'd been terrified of forgetting my lines and had memorized everything painstakingly, and now they wanted me to change it? I listened and nodded, but I was thinking, oh, fuck. I couldn't remember 10 notes about 2 lines of dialogue on the fly. Meanwhile, the audience sat up there waiting for action. It was way more nerve-wracking than doing stand-up. In my act, I knew what I was going to say. I'm in control of it. But I wasn't in control when I was being told what to do, how to say a word, stand, cross the stage, turn left. FYI, you can't turn your back on the audience ever. The nuances of shooting a sitcom were infinite, and I had to learn them while we were filming. With all that going on, it was impossible for me to judge how the shoot went. I thought we did a great job. After we finished, my father came down to the set full of compliments. He started talking to Tony, offering to help him with his research. Lana and Vanessa were like kindred spirits. My sister and mom took pictures with Tony and the cast, and we were obviously excited to be there. Seeing my family happy about my big night brought me out of my worry and into the moment. It meant a lot to have all of them there. My parents, wife, in-laws, sister, brother-in-law. I don't love a crowd outside of stand-up, but this was nice. I felt like everybody was on this journey with me, and we were on the ride together. That feeling of joy will get even more intense when Serafina is older and I could bring her to a sitcom taping. Not Sebastian says, unfortunately. Serafina might see the pilot episode one day. No one else ever will. A lot goes into a decision about which pilots the network will pick up for a TV season. They look at what's currently on air, what's doing well, and what makes sense to follow a hit TV show. I don't know every factor they considered or how they made their final cut, but in the end, they did not pick up my show. We were completely shocked and heartbroken. That year, NBC made 10 pilots and took 3. The odds were against us from the beginning, and I knew that, but I believed we'd get through. When we didn't, it was crushing. You put your blood, sweat, and tears, your whole life story into this one thing, and then in an instant, it's done. I could just go back on the road, back to comedy. For me, the TV show would have actually been a pay cut compared to what I made touring. But it wasn't about the money, of course. I felt terrible for the actors. We'd been gearing up for what would be years of an onstage family. They were banking on the network ordering 12 episodes so they'd have some steady work. Now the actors would have to psych themselves up to go through the audition process again and keep hitting it until they landed on a show with a future. How much of the show's failure was my fault? I tortured myself with this question in the months to follow. Did we do our best? Did we give all we could? Looking back, I think we did. But you always want to go above and beyond. Lana came to the emotional rescue and said, "The sitcom not working out clears the way for something else that will. Only time would tell if she was right." The sitcom's death wasn't it for me as an actor. I finally got my break playing a pivotal role as Johnny the Groundhog in the Nutjob 2, Nutty by Nature. By the time you hear this, I'm sure I'll have received my Oscar. I brought my 6-year-old niece to the red carpet premiere, and she was in heaven. I still wanted to see my face on the screen, not just my voice coming through a rodent's mouth. So I took what is known in Hollywood as general meetings. You go in, sit down with producers and directors just to talk and see if they have any projects that might be right for you, now and in the future. It's like, "Nice to meet you. Keep me in mind." Early in my career, I would have gone home from one of these meetings and waited with bated breath for the phone to ring and a producer to tell me he was going to cast me in his movie. But having been in the business for a while and gone up and down the emotional roller coaster, I knew not to get my hopes up, especially having created the pilot and seen the politics of getting a role or a show on the air. I learned firsthand how these things are so out of my control. So now I'd walk into these general meetings and go to the next thing without putting any pressure or expectations on anything. If the stars lined up and we both found that working together was a creative fit, then it would pan out. I would leave the meeting saying, if the phone rings, it rings. Great. If it doesn't, at least I have my comedy career to fall back on. I always feel for actors because most of them, that's just not the case. I was so comfortable with not getting acting roles that when I did get a call about appearing in a movie called Tag with Ed Helms, John Hamm, and Jeremy Renner, I wasn't all that excited about it. I would play a small part as a minister in a wedding scene with a few lines and, according to my agent, some improv. I don't like improv in front of a camera. It's hard enough to memorize the lines and come in on cue, but now I'd have to wing it? My agent convinced me to do it, saying it would be a good opportunity to be on camera in a big comedy. I couldn't deny that, and I agreed to do it. In hindsight, maybe I wasn't so excited about it because I was scared of doing something new. I never acted in a big movie before. Could I pull it off? Could I hold my own doing an improv scene with Ed Helms? Jeremy Renner had been nominated for an Oscar twice. I'd been surgeon number one on General Hospital. Along with fears about remembering my lines, I was anxious about how it all worked. My first day, I walked on to the Atlanta set of a movie that had been in production already for 3 weeks. I was the new guy. I didn't know anybody. They had already established their little cliques. It was first day at a new school type shit. I had a tight group of friends in junior high. But when we had to move up, all of them went to one high school, and I was alone at another one. It had to do with your address. They were all zoned for a different school, even though we lived near one another. My first day, I didn't know anybody, and I was really shy. In the cafeteria, I ate alone. I watched all the other kids talking and laughing while I just sat there miserable, believing that it would be like that every day for the next 4 years. Of course, it didn't work out that way, but the dread was so gut-wrenching. I'll never forget it. Whenever I feel acutely awkward and alone, I get a flashback, which happened on my first day on the set of Tag. The scene was in a large park outside, and they had me in a black suit. I was gushing three different types of sweat. One, regular sweat, that is my everyday norm. I run hot. Two, sweat from wearing a black wool suit in Atlanta in 100-degree heat, and three, a cold, damp, nervous sweat. I was losing so much water, my mouth went dry, and I was smacking my lips to get any moisture in there while going over my lines. I went wet and dry. I didn't know anyone. I'd never done this before. Then a knock on the door, and it was a production assistant who said, "They're ready for you on set." My heart started beating like crazy. I thought, this is new. My heart didn't beat like this when I went in front of 18,000 people to do stand-up. But to do a film scene in front of a few people? You would have been able to visually see my heart beating if I removed my shirt. So I followed the PA to the set, and it wasn't that quaint small scene that I had imagined. There was 100 extras. Plus a whole wedding party. As the minister, pastor, whatever, I was going to officiate the ceremony. Much to my great relief, I saw a familiar face. It was the producer who I'd gone on a general meeting with. As he walked over to me, I thought, oh, cool. I'll be able to hang by him and shoot the shit. Here we go. No more awkward feelings as if I don't know anyone. We could have lunch together, etc., etc. Next thing I know, he said, "I know you from somewhere." Like, we hadn't sat across a table from each other for an hour a few months ago. This played on my mind, too. It wasn't a, don't you know who I am, ego moment. It was an anxious, does anybody know why I'm here, moment. Nearby, I saw Renner, Helms, and Ham talking to each other. The old me would have gone in a corner and waited for someone to drag me out, but I made myself visible to them by walking over and introducing myself. It was low-key like, hey, I'm Sebastian. What's going on? Pleasantries were exchanged, and then they went back to what they had been talking about before I went over. So now what? I thought. Should I chime in? Pretend I see someone else that I need to talk to? Make a joke and peel away? While the three of them talked, I stood there planning my escape route. Usually, in this sort of situation, I try to leave on a laugh. Wait for people to crack up, and then I do a laughing 180-degree turn peel-off exit. I was so in my head because I wanted to talk to these guys, but I also needed to run my lines. I didn't want to be the 44-year-old guy who fucked up the scene because he was too busy trying to find someone to play with at recess. A few minutes later, I was called onto the set and I met Leslie Bibb, the female lead. She took one look at me and said, size 2 boots. You do a Prince bit, right? I love that. You're so funny. I thought, thank God, someone was familiar with my comedy. It was a moment of validation. One, I really needed to feel more at ease on this movie. Sometimes you need a little external support to give you a little boost of confidence. That's all. Standing in our places, I talked a little bit to Renner. I was feeling more comfortable and ready to deliver my lines. Then the director adjusted the lines and added backstory that threw a wrench into my whole plan. He told me to just do what I do, basically saying, don't worry about sticking to the lines. I said, okay, no problem. But in my head, I was going, fuck. But I just did it anyway. I learned that sometimes when the pressure is on and you're pushed into a situation that's unexpected, it's more natural and organic. On stage, I could hear people laughing. And that lets me know that whatever is coming out of my mouth is funny and things are going well. But on a movie set, you do your lines, and it's completely quiet. You don't hear anything. The whole time I was making up lines, having to rely on my internal comedic radar and to trust that what I was saying was funny. All you could do is prepare for what you know, trust in yourself, and that things will iron themselves out. FYI, I just got a peek at the edited scene last week. Whew. It turned out fantastic. With each take, my confidence grew, and I walked away from the set of Tag determined to do more acting. This experience was the first time I really had the opportunity to sink my teeth into a part and to adapt my comedic skills to a new and unfamiliar art form. I'm so glad I did it, and I proved to myself that I could hold my own with some really great actors. Having a comedic movie role where I have some creative freedom was a huge step. Now that I have that under my belt, I'm excited for the phone to ring with more opportunities. Now that I know I could do it, I have the confidence to pull it off. Last bite. When I do interviews, people always ask, "What's next for you?" I have absolutely no idea. It's best if you don't know. Yes, it's great to have goals in life and make plans, to have ambitions and big picture ideas, but looking back, I see that every break I got came totally out of the blue. I was working hard every day to advance my career, but what actually pushed me forward were those chance encounters, like being in the Comedy Store parking lot with Dice or in the stairway at Dublin's with Vince. The things I plotted, like my sitcom, literally didn't turn out like I hoped. And other things panned out in unpredictable ways. For instance, if I hadn't done the film Cruise, I wouldn't have tape of my dramatic acting to show casting directors to get work in movies. Fitting the filming of Cruise into my schedule was nearly impossible. I flew back and forth from New York to Florida 4 times in 1 week to make it happen. I was totally stressed out, but something in my gut told me to make it work. And now I've learned that my scene in it pushed me over the edge to land a part in a movie coming out next year. Some people might have ready answers to what's next off the top of their heads. They have a running list of everything they want to do, like opening a cheese shop in Manhattan, having 5 kids, winning an Oscar, or earning 7 figures. My philosophy is that if you plan too much, you might miss the random, unforeseen opportunities that could turn you around but ultimately take you where you want to go. Whatever happens is what happens. What's next is what's next. How's that for a life philosophy? 5 years ago, I couldn't have predicted where I'd end up. I can't predict where I'm going to be in 5 years from now. My only plan has always been to make people laugh. I set out to be a stand-up comedian. That's it. I never thought that I'd be sitting where I am now, reading this book in Los Angeles, with my amazing wife in our beautiful home, with our adorable baby, sleeping with her arms above her head like a little starfish upstairs. The days of gazing out the window at a lunatic humping his couch are long gone. I never imagined that my career in stand-up comedy would go as well as it has, or that I would find true love. And when I say true love, I mean a girl who monitors my caloric intake, makes me literally run up mountains, and found a nail lady to come to the house who also drops crab apples and passion fruit from her garden in our mailbox on a random Tuesday. I could have never planned these things or made this shit up. I just stayed hungry and worked for everything that came my way. It's all I could do, and what I plan on doing in the future. In this business, there's a fine line between reality and negativity. The iron is hot for me now, but it could burn out. Disappointment could be around the corner. I don't know. And that's the whole point. No one knows anything. Apologies to my wife, who likes to think everything is good and will keep being that way. I'm more comfortable believing that I could fall off the mountain at any time. Maybe that's what fuels me to dig in and hang on. I look at guys like The Rock or Kevin Hart, who are always positive, with the attitude like, I'm at the top of the mountain, but I'm going further. I'm going to the moon. Looking up at the moon might work for them. But what motivates and fuels me is looking down at my feet and putting one in front of the other.
Stay Hungry was written and read by Sebastian Maniscalco. It was recorded by Julian Nicholson at the Invisible Studios and by Daniel Spinelli at Planet Studios in Montreal, Canada. Editing and post-production by Like 2000 Pounds. The associate producer was Jennifer Lopes. Stay Hungry was produced and directed by Travis Tun. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Stay Hungry is available in hardcover from Gallery Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.